Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 332nd episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. And that is in Edmonton, but I am in Vancouver. James, where are you?
Unfortunately, right across the across the room from you. No, I don't mean that. It's a pleasure having you at the household.
Yeah, and thank God Hillary's here to take care
of you. Exactly. So, for those of you who listened to the last week's episode, you can tell that we probably do two of these at a time sometimes.
That's right.
Because there's no way Mike would have stayed here for a whole week.
Yeah, to do both of them.
Yeah, exactly. So if you guys remember, and I don't know how you could possibly have forgotten, we started off with the fascinating discussion about talking about erectile dysfunction, or as Mike liked to put it, erectile function.
Yeah. And we reviewed some of the features of diagnosis, some of the things that we have to think about in separating some of the primary causes, like is this a sudden onset or a slow onset, and do we have an actual thing that we can identify in the history that would indicate that there was a psychosocial stressor or something like that? And then we also talked about the measurement tools that are used within... That wasn't meant to be a pun, even though it sounded like that.
Yes.
It did. So, but some of the measurement mechanisms by which it's... by which erectile function is rated and scored, mm-hmm. and how those are... what scales they are and what's a meaningful change. We talked a little bit about what we think that
might... Well, not to bring it up again, because we're going to talk a lot about the medications. Right. And we also talked about, you know, that there are many drugs that can cause it, and you want to make sure you can get rid of those if they are the cause of the problem.
Yeah, if you can't get rid of them. And then some non-drug measures, like vacuum tubes. And I think the thing that was impressive was exercise.
Yeah. There was some stuff from systematic review and meta-analysis showing that exercise, you know, shifted... The description, I guess, if you will, the scale from a scale for erectile dysfunction, from, you know, you might go from mild to moderate up to mild, or mild to none, or mm-hmm. so it was, you know, it was a... And maybe why don't we just talk about that scale, because we're going to talk a lot about that as we go along. But there's basically a 25 point scale based on 5 questions that you ask. If you really want to know that, I don't want to read those questions again, because they were embarrassing to read anyway. Because you have to say the word erection and penetration. And you just can't say that. And Mike, you giggled the whole
last time. I know. Yeah. It's foolish, actually.
It is, yeah. And so anyway, there's a scale from 0 to 25, with 25 being no erectile dysfunction and 0 meaning...
Bad.
Bad, yes.
I think no function at all.
Really. Yeah. I mean, openly weeping.
That's very empathetic of you.
Yes.
Describe it like that.
So we... now actually have some reasonably effective treatments, as you know.
Yeah.
We have the phosphodiesterase inhibitors, if you will.
And we had treatments before, including the vacuum tube and some other things, but none as simple.
Yes.
And with such a clear effect. In fact, we talked about this before. There aren't a lot of medications in our armamentarium that treat a condition as... successfully as this does on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for everyone, but
it's really impressive. Yeah. I mean, and you know, when you do the numbers needed to treat, you know, we've always talked to, you know, about, you know, what is a good or bad numbers needed to treat, depending on what endpoint that you look at in this area, you may have an NNT of 2.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, other than proton pump inhibitors, well, general anesthesia is 1.
Yeah.
Because everybody falls asleep.
Yeah,
but other than that, we don't have as much. Now, one can debate whether this is a serious condition, but I think it does create serious psychosocial issues.
Yeah. I think it can certainly be considered a serious condition. We joked about it a lot to try and keep it lighthearted, but it is a serious condition, and it can be very disruptive, even for a couple, and mm-hmm. particularly, obviously, the male individual can feel very inferior and mm-hmm. inadequate and a whole bunch of things. So I think that this is an important condition, like many others, and the fact that there is such an effective treatment is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what a turning point for, like, we were really not having much that wasn't quite, really wasn't very men didn't want to use very often.
Yeah, and almost palatable, if you will. Because
I was going to say that word.
I know, but I just thought I'd say it and see where you'd go with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, because there were injections.
Absolutely, and I think you're going to talk about those.
Yeah, very little, because I'm not sure. I'm sure they're still used to some degree.
Yeah, no one uses them anymore.
Yeah. So, as we're talking about the phosphodiesterase inhibitors, and unless you were...
Living under a rock
for the last 50 years, you've heard of the word Viagra.
Yeah.
And so we, to the best of my understanding, we have three presently available. We have sildenafil, which is Viagra, mm-hmm. Vardenafil, which is Levitra, and tadalafil, which is Cialis.
Yeah.
Now, the first two, the should we break tradition and go with brand names, or should we...
I think you kind of have to talk about them a bit, because that's really how these products are known. So
we'll apologize ahead of time, but I think maybe easier, and we can actually say the words easier.
Yeah, for sure.
So the three we have: Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis. I know if I even say this word pharmacokinetic, you know, you go a little bit. In fact, it creates erectile dysfunction in you, doesn't it?
Loss
of interest.
The erection is me standing upright. I fall down and go to sleep. Yes. That's the loss of erection. Yeah. This case, it does matter, because one drug kind of sticks out differently than the other sticks out. There's nothing you can do here where the 14-year-old...
And it's not our fault.
No, all blame lies with someone else.
Yeah.
All
blame lies external.
Yeah, we try and look for other people. So, because there's, you know, there's also talk about, we're not going to get into this, but the BPH effects of some of these
right,
products,
yeah, yeah.
They can have some improvement with those symptoms. So, and obviously the longer lasting ones are the ones that are going to be preferentially used, and really that's one product.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the Viagra and Levitra, they're basically... The typical duration, and as you know, with any medication, it's going to vary. They say that it works for 12 hours, but it's not black and white like that. You don't go 11 and a half hours, still going good, 12 hours, it's nothing like that. But the recommendation is you take them 30 to 60 minutes ahead of time.
One of the things that's been really considered, not as good about these drugs is that you have to almost plan ahead somewhat, and I don't think, but I, you know, compared to where we were before, this is still far better.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have tadalafil, which is slightly longer acting and lasts for 36 hours. So in essence, I mean, you still, in essence, have to plan ahead.
Yes.
But you're planning ahead as in taking something today that might work tomorrow morning or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's just
a different... With your fingers crossed, as it were.
So to speak.
Yeah.
And I think we'll leave it at that.
Yeah. And then you'll just talk briefly about dosing, because I think that becomes relevant.
Yeah, so there's a variety of different dosage forms available, and they there's usually three dosage forms, but dosing strengths. Mm-hmm. 25, 50, and 100 for Viagra, 2.5, 5, 10, and then 20 for Levitra, and then 5, 10, and 20 for tadalafil. And the only reason we're saying that is that we're going to talk a little bit about the dose.
Right.
Of what works and so on. So they come in a variety of different doses. I'm going to suggest that most people should probably get the bigger doses, because we're going to talk about cutting tablets and blah,
right.
blah, blah.
Right, and this is a good time to remember that when you're buying a 25 milligram tablet versus a 100 milligram tablet, you're paying pennies more for the 100 milligram.
Almost always. Yeah, yeah, you're not paying four times as much.
No.
Yeah.
So you're almost always to buy better off. It's the same even with atorvastatin. If you're mm-hmm. going to buy atorvastatin, in many ways you should buy it as an 80 milligram tablet and cut it into quarters or
whatever. No, for sure. I mean, that's a great way to save money.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there's been some good systematic reviews and in fact a network meta-analysis. And whenever you hear the word network meta-analysis, again, that probably leads to erectile dysfunction. But it's really a network meta-analysis is done if we have very few head-to-head trials. Don't laugh at that.
I'm not. I'm
good.
I'm getting it together.
Very nicely controlled.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. One of the things that I've learned to do over 300 and something podcasts is ignore what you say.
Sorry, what was that?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. So anyway, this was in the European Urology Journal in 2013, and they looked at 118 trials of these medications. So that tells you something.
Yeah.
There's a lot of studies.
Well, there's a lot of studies, and it's because as I mentioned to you, these guys have looked at the not just the prescribing of this product and how well or not well it works, but one of the big things is they've tried it in everyone, and I've read a number of trials for just in patients with depression on an SSRI. Can this overcome there? So they've looked at different subgroups and in the way it should be done.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. And so it doesn't have to be organic. It doesn't have to be, it could be, you know, in people with diabetes and people, it doesn't matter what. So that's why there's so many studies. And they're not tremendously difficult to do. You don't have to have thousands and thousands of people.
No, anytime you're using a score, period, you can find benefit. But also in this, when a product is this effective, you don't need nearly as many people.
Yeah, you get, like, the study could be about 60 minutes in duration because it works that quickly.
with less than 60 people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, 118 trials, a total of about 31,000 people. And the outcomes that they looked at, they look at a global assessment questionnaire, and then they use that index of erectile function that we talked about earlier, that scale from 0 to 25. And they also have a bunch of other things where they look for adverse events and all sorts of different scores. But we probably should just cut to the chases about how effective they are. There are numerous studies that have looked at these agents compared to placebo. And almost without exception, depending on, there's some subtle differences, but it really looks like there's no doubt they're all effective.
Right.
And I don't think there's really much that you can, for lack of a better word, tease out that one is better than another.
No, I don't think that, you know, we're ever going to show that unless you look at something at 36 hours post. This may look better.
Yeah, yeah.
But, these drugs are very similar. The mean difference in the score we've been talking about is 6 to 7.5 points.
Yeah, so yeah.
And we knew that we were impressed with the benefit of exercise, which was about 4 points. Mm-hmm. So this is, these products, and when you look at cutoffs like satisfying sexual function, you get about a 30, often in a lot of the trials you see like a 30% effect in the placebo group and an 80 to 90% effect in the treatment arm.
Yeah, and no, exactly. As you mentioned with the numbers, when you extract the information out of that meta-analysis, you know, whether you look at sildenafil, vardenafil, or tadalafil, you're right. If you look at improvement in erection, it's around 80% with the medication and 30% on placebo, and it's almost the same right the way across. I mean, you can hardly, you can't really see any difference between it. Mm-hmm. And then so that's just improvement in erection. That's so about a, what is that, almost 50%, which is where we get a numbers needed to treat or an NNB, numbers needed to boink. That's a new term.
Yes, and I think it's probably, you're going to see that catch on.
Oh, it catches on. It's, you know, we don't report the news, we make it.
Yeah.
And then when you look at successful...
It's infective, really.
Really, yeah, yeah.
I didn't say effective.
No, I know. And then when you look at the endpoint of successful sexual intercourse, which, again, always baffles me is how...
Yeah.
One, yeah.
That one was successful.
Yeah, that wasn't. It depends who you ask. On placebo, about a third are successful. And then when you take these medications, it's about two-thirds.
Yeah.
You know, and those are the sort of numbers you can talk about. So, you know, 50% absolute improvement in erection and about a 30% absolute improvement in successful sexual intercourse. We have very few medications are any better than that.
Yeah, the 50 NNT of 2 or 3, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, these are, they are, as you said, PPIs. There's a few medications that are really effective in their target area, and so this is one of those few.
Yeah. So that's the best data we have on effect, and the nice thing about it, people will figure out very, very quickly whether it works. It's not going to work in 100% of people.
Yeah. And so, oh, absolutely not. And some of the trials are kind of I'll say cute the way they're written. Mm-hmm. One of the caveats for enrollment is you have to have a partner who's willing to have intercourse with you.
Right, yeah.
That's one of the enrolled... That was one of the recent... the most recent testosterone trial.
Yeah, yeah.
For the sexual function arm, you had to have a partner who was willing to do... So I'm not sure how they defined that, or I probably left it up to the person rather than asking the partner.
Yeah, and...
These are some of the nuances that you don't really think about from the outside, unless you're doing these trials, because you can't run a trial on sexual function with patients who aren't having sex or aren't likely to have sex.
Well, it depends. Well, although it brings to mind a comment of one of our colleagues, Bob Ragnar, who was he was, you know, talking about his first sexual experience, and he said, I remember it well. It was dark. I was nervous. I was alone. So it can be done.
And for the younger generation who haven't had the pleasure of seeing Bob present at
yes,
a conference and,
yeah.
and try desperately to stay on topic.
You have missed something.
You have missed something.
From the humor and also from the knowledge content.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely effective. And you get personal experience, Mike?
We're not going to go there.
Oh, this I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. I forgot.
Your journey.
Yeah, that was my journey. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But let's talk about the average events, because it is interesting that, and I've, one of the lines I always gave when I taught about sildenafil and these other phosphodiesterase inhibitors, one of the things is that they do very frequently cause headache, for example, mm-hmm. but no one ever withdraws due to the headache. And sorry, that wasn't intentional.
Not the right word.
Yeah. But it is
stops the study.
Stops the withdrawal from
the study. Yeah.
God, this is terrible.
Yeah, it is. Anyway, so you're right. Yeah, I mean, if you actually look at the side effect, this drug wouldn't even make it on the market because the amount of side effects, but because of the treatment, is what it's treating.
Yeah.
So when you actually look at the data, it's fairly impressive, if you will, the number of side effects. Anyone reporting an adverse event, adverse effect, it's 45% in the drug group and 25%. In the placebo group. So that's a 20% absolute increase in adverse events.
Oh, I know. And it's not, yeah. And some of them, the study that I recalled was a 25% absolute rate mm-hmm. of headache. Now the placebo rate was around 5. But
yeah, yeah.
I see here in your pooled analysis, it's 10 to 15 versus 2
yeah.
to 4.
So we still, you know, 10%, 15% chance of headaches. And
yeah, 1 in 8 people are going to get a headache.
Yeah.
But they're not going to.
Really, they're not going to care. Apparently.
It is interesting because it doesn't... In most of these studies, too, maybe you saw this stopping the medication or stopping in the trial due to adverse events. Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing that occurring very often.
No, well, the one trial I remember in looking at it, I think it was a New England Journal article, and they talked about all of these side effects, and I think the number of people who stopped because of the drug, it was like 1%.
Yeah.
And probably the person who was not actually getting an effect.
Well, that's just it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, but when you look down this list of side effects, you talk about flushing, headaches. I mean, there's dyspepsia, 5% versus 1%. Back pain, 5% versus 2%. And these are all statistically significant increases. There's myalgia. There's dizziness. There's rhinitis. And again?
It's just too easy.
It's just too
easy. Just skim right over
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. And so... These drugs are not without side effects. One could argue it would be very hard to blind these studies anyway.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like...
I don't just mean from a side effect perspective.
But it's very similar to orlistat, right? That medication mm-hmm. for weight loss. After they're done, some of the trials have actually said, which group did you think you're in? And most patients can figure out what group they're in.
Well,
because
duh.
They weren't pooping themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
So the same is true here. They do, people can pretty quickly sort out what group they're in.
Yeah. And so, as with all of the, you know, whenever we have podcasts, we always have to bring up the issue of dose, right, Mike?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's my Viagra.
It's what gets you going.
Yes.
What gets you up in the morning, so to speak.
So to speak, yes. And so, as we know, you know, almost all adverse events are dose-related. You know, probably 75 or 80% at least are probably dose-related. And what's kind of interesting is that, you know, there are studies that have looked at, you know, different doses of these agents. Now, the one that we sort of have in front of us is, you know, on basically just for Viagra or sildenafil. Okay. But when it first came on the market, I'm pretty sure it was a 100 milligram tablet.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm but not that I remember personally, but I think it was 100 milligrams, and that was the dose that was shown to work, mm-hmm. but also have the side effects. And I think very, very quickly people figured out that lower doses would work, and we actually have reasonably good evidence that, you know, doses of, you know, you cut 100 in half, get 50, you cut it in half again, get 25. And it's pretty similar.
Certainly effect. The number, like the depending on the outcome you're looking at, there's only really one that makes any kind of, it gets 15% better for the outcome of men with self-reported improvement in erections.
Yeah.
But number of intercourses that are successful and all those kind of things really are unchanged in any way from 25 to 100.
Yeah, and in fact, the 25, all of these, the confidence intervals around all those different things are all overlapping and all that sort of. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's really not no different.
I think this advocates, now certainly some men will need a higher dose, but I would advocate for my patients, I generally prescribe them 100 milligrams, and I tell them to at least cut it into quarters.
Yeah, yeah, and potentially even lower, because we now establish that a quarter is as good. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we found the lowest dose.
No, not at all, right?
Yeah.
And there was, I can't recall where this was, but there's a lot of over-the-counter products that you can get that and natural products, apparently, mm-hmm. that are natural, that are for this condition. And when I think it was the FDA or group did looked at a number of them and found that one of the most consistent ingredients in these products was sildenafil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that they were just sneaking it in, and often at 6 milligrams or 10 milligrams or that kind of dose.
No, exactly.
And so it was many of them were effective, but really because of that they had a pharmaceutical product.
Yeah, and then when you look at actually the evidence on do lower doses have less side effects, it's not a perfect correlation, but certainly, if you look at the 100 milligram of the top dose compared to the lowest dose, there's definitely differences.
Yeah.
And so, again, whether or not a person who is having side effects at 100 will have no side effects at 25, I don't think you could say that. But certainly the evidence is, that why would you even not try a quarter if it worked just as well?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
From a cost perspective and so on.
Yeah.
So that's basically the information that we have for these agents. Is there anything else you want to add, Mike? There's a couple of some contraindications that we should talk about quickly. Yeah. But
one of the things you mentioned was cost, and I think that is key, because you take a 100 milligram pill, which is going to be very similar to the 25.
Yeah.
You quarter it or even eighth it, and you're talking about now, instead of spending $10 to $15 a pill, you're talking about $2 or that kind of thing. So your weight, it is beneficial for a number of reasons.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So I think we'd be remiss if we didn't just talk a little bit about the contraindications. I mean, the biggest concern is, and here's where it gets tricky, we're primarily going to be using these agents in people who have atherosclerotic reasons for erectile dysfunction. And, you know, it's tricky to know. The concern is using it in people who have any sort of, I guess, ischemic heart disease.
Yeah, particularly if you're giving them nitrates.
And so the only contraindication that I'm aware of, whether all contraindications are absolute contraindications, but, you know, there's certainly a suggestion that you should not use nitrates within 24 hours of using sildenafil or vardenafil, which are the 12-hour ones, or the 12-hour duration, mm-hmm. and then, or tadalafil within 48 hours. So, you know, that's sort of just the contraindication. And obviously, there are a couple times when you want to seek medical help, like a priapism, which is defined as an erection lasting longer than 4 hours. I don't know whether you just want to seek medical help or just let people know
about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
but it can cause serious.
You know, it's not something. It seems like a good idea
At the time.
Yeah, until it happens to you. So.
Yeah.
No, it can be. It can be obviously, and often very painful too. So
and
they do seek help.
For that. And obviously, any chest pain.
Yeah.
Associated with you should probably check that.
I think anytime you have chest pain, period, you should probably. Unless you have a good cause for that chest pain, like someone sitting on your chest.
Does that happen often?
Back to the wrestling match.
Oh, the wrestling match. The mud.
Yeah.
Oh, good grief. I'm supposed to follow that along?
Still the same day.
Yeah, exactly. The other ones, and these were available before the sort of Viagra drugs, is the prostaglandin E1 analogs, the injections and urethral pellets. But just looking at the pictures.
Well, yeah, in fact, in my, since the phosphodiesterases have come along, I only have one patient in my practice who uses any of these types of approaches.
Yeah.
And that because it was very severe.
Yeah. And I would suggest that they're probably... I'm not aware of any head-to-head comparison, so to speak, but they do work.
Yeah, they yeah.
And, you know, they probably work a little bit faster.
Yeah.
But even then, it may not be, yeah. I mean, the suggestion is that they work within 5 to 10 minutes, whereas the other agents are, you know, you got to take it 30 to 60 minutes ahead of time. But, yeah, like I said, these are potential, but I doubt that there's much even research on going on with these right now.
No, I think they're, unless we can figure out how to give them as an oral tablet or a patch or something you inhale uses a meter dose inhaler in some way. You've got to have a simple delivery system for these,
Now I think we'd be a little bit remiss if we didn't just mention testosterone,
right?
And there was a tools for practice done on that,
right? And the tools for practice, interestingly, so it was done by Adrienne Lindblad, who's obviously a member of our team, and she did an excellent review of the available evidence, and it talked about a moderate improvements in erectile function and libido, and the standard mean differences were actually quite big. Again, pardon the pun, for the changes in sexual function. But subsequent to that, and the trouble with standard mean differences is they're uninterpretable, really, for clinical application. So what we've always needed is a larger RCT that we could really get some more reliable information and how much it's actually changing function. And so that came out just this year, the testosterone study, and it was a 3-arm study, like 3 different groups were being examined, but and we've talked about this already, but for the sexual function component of that trial, there's really the actual change in sexual function scores was only 5%. So if you were, which is nothing compared to exercise or these phosphodiesterase drugs.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It really doesn't, for the vast majority of people with a moderately low testosterone level, it doesn't make a big difference in sexual function. Now, if somebody had a profound deficiency, I suspect it would make play a bigger role there. But
yeah.
For the average aging male who's been targeted for testosterone or androgen replacement, if you like, it's not nearly as successful as we would have hoped.
Yeah, no, and exactly. And there's a study from a couple of years ago that looked at, you know, if you are truly hypogonadal, it does seem to have an effect. You know, if you truly have, you know,
I guess
for lack of a word, pathologically low testosterone.
Yeah, yeah. And the people in these trials are just kind of below the lower cutoff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where they are. They're
yeah.
not drastically below. And so the difference is that it's making with them is relatively small.
Yeah. So I don't know if we really need to talk a lot about testosterone. I mean,
no.
it's not the sort of thing that you could just, you can't just take it and then an hour later.
No. This is something you're actually
exactly.
trying to, and men who take it will report things like it's improving their interest in sex and more than just ED. But the ED portion of it is only improved by about 5%.
Yeah, yeah.
So not large at all.
Yeah. And obviously there's a whole slew of adverse effects associated with testosterone. And again, you know, if I was to use anything like this, which I haven't.
You're willing to admit.
I will admit that. even though I'm 112 years old. you know, I think, you know, being able to just take a pill at the time and so on versus having to deal with all the side effects associated with testosterone, I think if it was just for erectile function, I don't think there's any argument.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we might be a little remiss in also not mentioning that there is more than just erectile dysfunction issues.
Yeah,
and I thought
sexual
it might,
function.
Yeah, I thought that might be just an interesting for the listeners, if you will. There was just recently in the European Urology Journal from 2016, a systematic review and meta-analysis of pharmacological management of premature ejaculation. And so there were 22 studies, and I'm not going to spend too much time on that.
You're trying to rush through this?
Yeah, I want to get it over quickly. Oh, there we go. It's done. Anyway, 22 studies, and there is a number of treatments that have been shown to be more effective than placebo at increasing... I like this. IELT. Had you ever heard what that was?
No.
No. Intravaginal ejaculation latency time.
What a world we live in.
So if you have a, if you would like to...
We're laughing about this, but this too is a serious condition. This is a serious condition for some people. And I've heard it argued that this is not a really important condition by sexual health people. Mm-hmm. That it's the problem is that there's an unreal expectation for these men to last longer. And I think that actually dismisses it too simply. Mm-hmm. Because the men also... who suffer from this condition, most of them would like a change and improvement.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah,
So, you know, we joke about all of this stuff, but it's not that we don't recognize that this is a. It can be very disruptive, yeah. And some of these people, it's just like they joke about on all the television shows and everything that often ejaculation can occur even before intercourse.
Yeah, but in most cases for me, yes, always. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm trying to take it up a notch.
No.
Just one notch, no. maybe from age 14 to 15.
Yeah.
Could you go there?
But anyway, so let's mention what is better than placebo.
Okay.
The SSRIs, topical anesthetic creams, tramadol, the phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors are more effective than placebo. So all of those have been shown to be more effective at increasing intravaginal ejaculation latency time. Okay. And the issue is when you look at the average difference, it's about 1.39 minute increase. Now, for some people, it's hard to know what is clinically relevant in this area. You make up your own jokes.
1.39 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, that's... 4 or 5 times longer than normal, is it not?
It is a joke that does definitely write itself.
It does, yeah.
At the pipe conference, somebody asked me if chocolate can be considered an aphrodisiac because I had reviewed the health risks and benefits of chocolate. And it's interesting, at that time I didn't know. I did go home and look it up. There was only one study that has examined it that I could find, and it didn't find an effect from chocolate. But one of the interesting things is for mood with chocolate, the effect of a positive mood from eating chocolate lasts at most 2 minutes. Mm. So this 1.39 minutes fits within that 2 minutes. So for potentially it could be considered an aphrodisiac for that within that given time
mm-hmm.
frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there you go.
So times are matching up.
Mm-hmm. So, and just very, very quickly, and just because there is a systematic review and meta-analysis that's just come out recently looking at flibanserin. Now, I know Tina has done, I was going to say she's done flibanserin, but that, again, not personally. She's done a review of this.
Yeoman's work on this. I mean, she really did a lot of review of it. And interestingly, she published the Tools for Practice or presented on, I can't remember which came mm-hmm. first, whether she... But subsequently, there was a systematic review done of it and it had the exact same conclusions that she had already...
Yeah, which makes sense because they're all looking at the same data. Yeah. And she's very competent.
it turns out.
Yeah. And like I said, these two podcasts have been about erectile dysfunction, but I think we can... There's no... The condition, if you will, and it's debatable. I don't even know if I want to talk too much either one way or the other, but it's called hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's a disorder, it is an issue.
Yeah,
you know, for some people, and an important issue, and so we're not trying to make light of it at all. The unfortunate thing is when you look at, you know, flibanserin, you know, which is called the male Viagra, the female Viagra.
Yeah, and that's very much false advertising.
Oh, if it was really the female Viagra, and it worked as well as Viagra, that would be something.
Yeah, exactly.
But when you look at this, and I think this is pretty much what Tina came up with, was this systematic review done this year, 5 published studies, 3 unpublished, and the average increase in satisfying sexual events is about a 1/2 additional per month.
I know. And the falls and dizziness that's associated with this problem is outrageous. So, yeah, this is... To me, it would be hard to imagine when you went over the plus and minuses of this product with the patient that they would actually choose to take it.
Yeah, and I remember reading somewhere, I think this was, I think it came on the market, what about, within the last year? I'm trying to think exactly.
Yeah, I don't know if it's available in Canada, but it certainly is available in the States.
And I remember reading somewhere where they said, and so far there's been a total of 300 prescriptions for this. And and you're going, in everywhere? And yeah, so this is not... And there was a lot of lobbying by some groups to get the FDA to
approve this.
And, you know, you can guess where almost all the pressure came from. Yeah. It wasn't from women necessarily.
There were some women who joined in, but it was initiated and really pushed by the manufacturer. And they created a campaign called Even the Score because they said all these products were available for men, but none for women.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's true, I don't think that's why this was being held back by the FDA. It's just, it causes syncope, it causes fainting, dizziness.
In about 10% of people. So it's kind of like, it's got all the side effects of Viagra, but none of the benefit.
Yeah.
You know?
And in most of the studies where they're trying to determine its safety were done in young men.
Yeah.
So
which is, really interesting.
Yeah.
So let's just quickly wrap up a few points, some key points about erectile dysfunction. We talk about establishing the timing of it to help us give us some guidelines as far as assessment. If it does happen to be associated with people who are getting older and you're and it's sort of being something that's come on gradually, you may want to do a CBD risk assessment. Mm-hmm. Not that necessarily the treatment of it, but it is possible that might have some benefit, especially if they're smoking, because that's a clear, there's a number of drugs that can cause this. So
for sure,
if you can get rid of those, there are a number of non-drug treatments that work. We talked about a meta-analysis on activity that showed, I think, not an unimportant benefit.
Yeah,
if you will.
Sure.
We made fun of the pump a little bit. Well, at least you did. I was very mature.
Respectful and mature, and
I would like to apologize.
I degraded. Yes. I think the whole podcast.
I
took it to a very low level.
When you're being evidence based, I'm not going to argue with you.
And I probably even belittled Mike Myers' movies.
Oh, of course you did. So the phosphodiesterase inhibitors, they work about 50%, but they also have side effects in about 10-20%. But apparently, no one cares.
They have a 50%. Effectiveness over and above placebo.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the big message was use low doses for price and side effects.
Podcast 1 to 350 or whatever.
Is use low doses.
Yeah, low doses.
Except
at 350, we're changing it.
Are we?
Yeah, to use high doses only.
For everything.
Everything.
Yes, stat. IV. And then we just mentioned that this flibanserin works about a half an episode per month, but also produces side effects and has a black box warning.
Yeah.
So do with it what you may.
I mean, that product isn't really catching fire, as it were, and I don't think it's going to.
No, exactly. I think we'll leave it at that. Continue. I hope you guys will, despite these last two podcasts, you will continue to listen to them. We would love it if you would check out our website. We'd love it actually if you go to iTunes and leave us some commentary, hopefully nice commentary, because it helps with the ratings, and it's because it's all we have to live for nowadays. erectile dysfunction, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the lack of effective flibanserin.
Yeah, what we got? We got nothing. So if you could do that, that'd be great. Check out all the things that we do. Go to Tools of Practice, because as we speak, I'm sure there'll be more coming out. Our Best Science Medicine course is coming up in lovely Vancouver in April 7th and April 8th. So hopefully by early January, you'll be able to sign up for that course if you'd like to attend, and we'd love it if you would. So anything else?
Nope, that's all.
So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.